It looks like we have more the hardcore students this morning. I recognize all of you. You okay? Everything? Let's begin with a little quieting meditation. Maybe you know of the various meditations, this meditation on the breath that we begin with often is renowned in Buddhism. I think I mentioned one of the other talks at the beginning of many, many sutras. Not everyone, but many. There would be some story about the Buddha was residing at a certain place with a certain number of disciples. And it says that in the morning he went out for alms. Went for alms. Do you know what alms are? What are alms? What are alms? You nodded, yes. What? Food. So he went out to the fast food place, or what? He went to a restaurant? Okay. Sometimes people think alms means begging, right? But if you've seen a statue, it's interesting, we don't have a statue here of Buddha with the two disciples or a tanka, do we? Or is there one here that I don't see? Usually the two disciples, Shariputra on one side and Mahamoggallana on the other side, they're holding these staffs. I think they're called kasil. I'm not sure if that's the Sanskrit or the Tibetan. And so they would come to a house, they would go around on their alms round, and they would shake this. It kind of like a doorbell, you know, or like a gong. I mean, that we're here. And if the people wanted to make offerings of food, the laity, they would come up and offer alms. If they didn't want to, the monks would move on. So it was considered part of the relationship between the mutually beneficial relationship between the Sangha and the laity for the monks to go for alms, because they gave the opportunity for the laity to make offerings. Sometimes they would offer also clothing. Sometimes if they were had enough means, they would offer housing, you know, the monasteries, the famous grounds that the Buddha had, his various monasteries and so forth. So the Buddha went out for alms, came back, ate his food, washed his hands and feet, and sat down at the beginning of the sutras and said, and placed his attention on the mindfulness and placed his mindfulness on the breath in front. So he was watching the breathing. So this leads into what we're going to be talking about in the class after we do our motivation, the four close placements of mindfulness, but also the fact that the breathing has a relationship with our thoughts. All of our mental states are said to ride on wind, on some prana or chi, like a rider rides on a horse. The horse is like the mobility, the mount, and what is mounted on that is the mind. The mind is riding on that. So when you can control, the breathing is very, very exceptional as a beginning object of meditation, because as you focus on the breathing and it becomes regular, the random thoughts that are coming through our mind, they start to diminish just by the force of the object. So this is a very special object. So let's begin with that. We're going to move from that to some of the other objects. So without controlling your breathing, relax your body, just as though you were listening to a sound without creating any sound. Just be aware of your breathing with your consciousness. Use the factor of discrimination to recognize not only the breathing, but what kind of breathing it is, whether it is an inhalation or an exhalation or the turning points between the two. And when the mind is somewhat settled, follow one inhalation through your nostrils up as though it were going to the top of your head, crown of your head, and then down to your throat, to your heart, the middle of your chest, heart chakra, we say. Leave your attention there. Leave your breath there. Of course, you'll continue breathing. But now place your attention on the mind itself, the contents of the mind. See if you can notice thoughts that are arising that are of the past memories, some observations of the present. Maybe you hear, you get distracted to the air conditioning or some sound. Or future-oriented thoughts, plans, what you're going to do later. Watch your reaction to those thoughts. The mind might, as it pays attention to some of them, might be attracted with some sort of, attachment, some wishing to dwell on that thought. Other thoughts are more agitating. Even though we'd like to be rid of the response, some sort of repulsion or anger, our natural response is just to become agitated as though we'd like to get rid of the object of that thought. Some thoughts be arising without any particular reaction to them, but in a sense oblivious of the fact that these thoughts still are in a continuum of a contaminated mind. Look very deep into the mind. See if you can see these thoughts arising. And then try to notice take your attention away from the objective thoughts that our mind focuses on, coming one after the other, to the space between the thoughts. When there's a moment of quiet, the nature of the mind. So begin to withdraw your attention away from being involved with the thoughts as we were when we were observing them first. Seeing if you can see the space between the thoughts in the sense of time, and even where the thoughts are, recognizing the open nature, the clear nature of the mind within which these thoughts are arising. In short, focus more on the subjective mind rather than the objective thoughts that are the objects of that mind. the nature of this mental consciousness, the nature of all of our consciousness, is a clarity, a certain sense of clarity. In one way, it's the immateriality. It's not form. It's not obstructive. It doesn't obstruct thoughts from coming nor hold them in it. And it's clear in the sense of illuminating whatever appears to it, arising in the aspect of whatever appears to it, like a mirror. It's a clear light nature. Also, its function is to know its objects. Here is, we're not focusing on the objective thoughts, but the mind itself. One part of the mind is trying to know with some kind of awareness this nature of the mind. It's being open, clear, illuminating, reflective. That clear light nature of the mind, I think, is a hidden object. So it's not something that we can perceive immediately with our mental perception. We have to build up a mental image of it through this kind of experience of the mind. Recognizing this mind's openness, you know, to the arisal of new thoughts, its nature is not being one with the delusions. The delusions can be, you know, the disturbing states of mind that focus on various thoughts, objects. They're transitory. They can disappear. Recognizing this is our conventional Buddha nature, and that we have it simultaneous with having this life of leisure and endowment that can recognize it. I'm going to use this opportunity, this life, this year, this month, this day, this very moment, to let go of the discordant states of mind, or my afflictive states of mind, bad motivations that are, let me say, mainly thinking only of the present, thinking only of me, thinking only of my pleasure, or eliminating suffering, or just at the temporally, just right now. Think that I can replace that with positive states of mind that are aiming to heal myself in a more fundamental way, for not just the present, but the future also. I can develop a state of mind of renunciation that recognizes all of the attractions, all of the so-called samsaric perfections, wealth and power and sensual enjoyment and so forth, as being of the nature of suffering, being transitory, being impermanent, not having any real essence. And those very attractive objects that we've put our attention on as being the cause of future suffering, the doorway of all sufferings, are running after them, like running into a burning building to retrieve your money, but only to be burned up by the building again and again. I think I'm going to spend this time, the next hour and a half, 2 hours, listening to the teachings critically, perhaps asking questions or making corrections when something becomes very clear, some gem of Dharma, so to speak. I'll try to hold that single-pointedly, try to meditate on that if I come to some conclusion, some clarity. Why am I doing this? To heal myself in a fundamental way, to escape from cyclic existence, but more from a Mahayana point of view, I'm going to participate, listen to the teachings with the aim in mind of achieving enlightenment, accumulating merit, accumulating knowledge, and listening to the teachings with that goal in mind, accumulating the methods, the virtuous dharmas, understandings, thinking around us in space, all living sentient beings, all mother sentient beings. We're all going to the same destination. We all eventually will achieve enlightenment according to our karma. There's no one to feel jealous of. There's no one to feel superior to. All of our mothers, exactly in the same plight as us, wanting desperately to have happiness, but not recognizing the cause of that happiness, often destroying it, the causes of happiness, not wanting even the slightest suffering, but continuing to create the causes of suffering. Seeing ourself in all other living beings. Think I'm going to participate in this practice, listening to the teachings, contemplating and meditating on it, for their benefit, to get closer to the state of enlightenment. In which I can truly work for their benefit without any hindrance, effortlessly, spontaneously, and correctly. And then bring your attention back to the present. More people appeared. So. Let me give you a chance at the beginning to ask any questions that you may have stored up, either from previous class or from other classes, or any comment you'd like to make. Yes. Oh, good. You've taken some notes or something.
Venerable, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah.
I have two questions from the last session on the four close placement of mindfulness. First one, I'm just wondering, how does our mind multitask? How does our mind multitask?
Multitask?
Yes. I'm just wondering, can two mental consciousness focus on their tasks at the same time? For example, visualizing and mentally reciting mantra at the same time. Can this be done, or is one of the tasks a distraction for the other mind? That's my first question. You get what I mean? Like when you visualize, in Tibetan Buddhism, we are encouraged to visualize a lot. And then say you visualize a Buddha, and you also chant a mantra. Mm-hmm. So how does this work? When we chant a mantra and we visualize a Buddha, is it that there are two mental consciousness that is operating at the same time? Or is it that when we chant a mantra and visualizing a Buddha, we're actually using one mental consciousness and the other one is actually a distraction, so we can't really focus on two things? It's like, this is my question about multitasking. How does it really work?
Okay. Yeah? So, generally, do you think you have two mental consciousnesses? Do you have more than one? Or you say no? Anyone think you have more than one mental consciousness? It might seem like that sometime, like you might think one is focused on one thing and one is focused on another. Generally, we say that we have only one stream of consciousness of any of our senses. You have two eyes, but you have only one eye consciousness. It's kind of a combination of those receptors, I guess. Only one ear consciousness, one nose consciousness, one tongue consciousness, one body consciousness, and only one mental consciousness, kind of like a stream. So when we become a Buddha, the Buddha's body, his speech or her speech, and her mind, I'm being sort of American style saying, instead of saying it, or, you know, it's because the Buddha experience is not male or female, but just the Buddha's body, speech, and mind are all unified and function at the same time. So right now, when you, say for instance, if you do a meditation on Shakyamuni Buddha, there's one of the only practices that I know of that the Buddha gave permission to engage in visualizing yourself also as a deity is as Shakyamuni Buddha. Did you know that? There's some meditation when you can visualize Buddha in front, and then after, you know, collecting merit by making offerings and requests and so forth, confession, rejoicing, the Buddha comes. You imagine entering into you, into your mind, and you meditate on oneness with the Guru. There are many, many ways to do, you know, in many different levels of sophistication. But then at the end, imagine that you yourself arise as Buddha. So you concentrate on that for some time. The appearance, you know, your face, your little curl of hair here, and a crown knot, and long ears, and various signs in the palms of your hands and the soles of your feet, and so forth, the various signs of Buddha, the clothes that you as Buddha is wearing are not touching the body. They're actually, you know, emanation of the mind. And then you can visualize at your heart the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha. Tadyata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soa. Now that appears as form that you're visualizing, and then you can begin to recite that mantra, first recognizing that that form is kind of vibrating, because sound is a kind of form, right? When we talked in the other class, when we talked about the three kinds of impermanent phenomena, remember what they were? Or maybe you weren't in the class. Form, consciousness, and what we call non-associated factors that are neither consciousness nor form. So is sound, what is sound? Is sound consciousness? Sound is neither form nor consciousness. Sound is form, some kind of form. So sound is subtle kind of form. But when we start talking about this, we get into the practice of Tantra. So this subtle form is kind of a subtle wind, this sound. To recognize that sound and the wind, the prana or chi, are the same thing as one of the special realizations. So I think on a higher level, it's possible that these are not, will not distract from one another. But there's say at the beginning level, you would spend your time first visualizing yourself as Shakyamuni or whatever deity. And then when use that as an object of concentration of your shamatha meditation, then when you get fatigued, because the mind can only keep that kind of effort, keeping this whole visualization present at one time, it's then that you engage in the recitation of mantra. And in the recitation of mantra, there are various subsidiary visualizations, sending out light, benefiting sentient beings, withdrawing that, sending out light, making offerings to the Buddhas, and so forth. So all of those visualizations are, in a sense, purifying your prana, your chi, sending out, bringing back, so forth. So they can enhance your visualization, but they're on a slightly grosser level. When you're visualizing the body of the Buddha, it's more just a mental activity, whereas in the recitation of the mantra, it's more of a moving of the winds and so forth. So although it might seem distractive, it's meant to be a means of accumulating merit and developing compassion and so forth, which are the motivating factors for visualizing yourself. So they're supporting one another. So they're alternative. You still would try to keep the visualization of yourself partially in your mind, but that doesn't mean that there are two minds present. In our lower class, we were talking about the mental consciousness has the ability to pay attention to a certain number of things, but if it really concentrates on one of them very, very thoroughly, the other ones become inattentive. They may be appearing to your senses, but you are, because you don't pay sufficient attention to them, you're paying more attention to something else. They become sort of background, but you don't notice. So you can put some energy into both yourself, the divine, you know, the sense of I am Buddha, or you know, the appearance of yourself, and also the recitation of the mantra. So you're kind of splitting your attention, but it's just one mental consciousness, I think. I can't say much more than that. Okay. You have another. You have a follow-up question.
But regarding the same question, right? So does it? Can I say that for multitasking, a eye consciousness or ear consciousness and the mental consciousness can operate at the same time, but a mental consciousness, there's only one, so you can't do two things at the same time with the mental consciousness. Can I conclude that way? Like if you're watching TV, you're using your eye consciousness, and you're thinking about something else, you're using a mental consciousness. That one can be done at the same time.
Well, you can see, you can notice if you're watching the TV and then it brings up some thought, you know, oh, that's a nice potato peeler. You know, some advertisement. Oh, I should go. I think it's sold down in Bukittimma or you know, someplace. When you're starting to think, your mental consciousness is no longer paying attention to what you're seeing. I mean, it's still there, but it's becoming more and more you're becoming inattentive of that. It may still be, the eye consciousness still may be functioning. Eye consciousness, the wind upon which the eye consciousness rides may be up in the eye organ. But your mental consciousness may not be paying enough attention to that for you to recall what is coming next. Maybe they're selling something else next, or the episode that you want to watch is beginning. That's how I understand it. So we have one stream of mental consciousness that has the ability to pay partial attention to some things. If you spread it out over many things, all of them are going to be very minimally attended to. Okay, like say right now. See if you can pay attention to your eye consciousness, what you're hearing. Oh, see, almost seems like you have to go between one and the other. So the air conditioning. I think that's air conditioning, right? Okay. Eye consciousness. Ear consciousness, so listening to the question or the reply. Can you smell at the same time? Pay attention to the smell. Actually, if you really, because there's probably not a strong fragrance or odor around you, you have to pay more attention to that. And then you don't, you're paying less attention to the eyesight. So you try that. Yeah, it's almost like it starts, the visual consciousness becomes fading a little bit. This is my experience. How about your tongue? I've got a little dry mouth right now. I had some lemon juice before. This water doesn't have a particular taste. It's not a flavored water. So your tongue, taste anything in your mouth? Is there a sour taste or a acidic taste? So you keep your eyes open, listen, smell, taste. Oh, you can't really pay attention to all of them at the same time. There's one. Some of the other ones fade. How about your body? Just the sense of your body. You know, your arms, your legs, your belly, your head, your ears, even the parts of your body, to focus on different parts, other parts go out of focus. At least that's my experience. So I think this is my understanding. Generally in Buddhism we say there is only one continuum of any of the consciousnesses. So there's only one mental consciousness, and it has the ability to focus on various things, and perhaps to divide its attention a little bit. But if you start to, there's no special demarcation how many you can pay attention to. If you become a Buddha, you're attentive of everything, all phenomena at the same time, all the objects of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, tactile, all mental objects. When you become an Arya being, if you have what in the Sautrantika system they call yogic direct perception, whatever you're perceiving there is totally attentive of, but you're not attentive of the eyes and ears and so forth. It's just the mental consciousness is concentrating. So we're just beginners, we're just babies in that respect. So the term multitask is something I know my friends in the States use. One friend, while she's driving her car, she wants to talk at the same time. But what did the police say? They say that as you're talking on your phone, you're concentrating on that. Even if you think you're looking at the road, your mind may be, what are you talking about? Julia is now David dating David? What happened to Jim? And you don't pay attention to what you might think you're looking at the road, but you're not paying sufficient attention. So multitasking has this, I guess that's what the modern 20th century lingo, that's what you'd say that the mental consciousness is doing, but it has only a certain capacity to do that at present. That's my understanding. Does anyone have some different understanding? Okay. Yeah, you have a question. Okay, she has different understanding.
Sorry, I'm not sure this will help, but it's just that I think it's a semantic problem that has come with the term multitasking, which in fact is a myth. It doesn't exist. Our mind is actually working at every task sequentially, and that mindfulness has a lot to do with the focus that the mind has. And often when people refer to multitasking, they are just imagining that the cognitive side of the brain is doing a few things.
But the mental, you mean by cognitive side of the mind, you mean the mental consciousness?
Yes, and the point where there is the cognitive analytical aspect of it. But when the mind is also capable of perceptions, which are not necessarily cognitive, and it can...
What do you mean, perceptions that are not cognitive? What is cognitive?
The experience is experiential. So when we are actually focusing, for example, very often His Holiness will say during one of his teachings, when you're saying a mantra, it's good to reflect on the meaning of, the words in the mantra. And that actually helps the mind to focus on that meaning. Mm-hmm. And so for the practitioners who are able to do that and think deeply about just the words, it opens a variety of reflections and so on at the time they recite the mantra. Mm-hmm. For others who are visualizing at that particular point when they chant the mantra, then it helps to focus, which object they wish to focus on. So the notion that this is multitasking is actually a miscomprehension of the term, because multitasking is given, people this idea that you can divide the mind into all these things, but that's actually a myth. It actually doesn't exist.
Well, yeah, I think you're kind of contradicting your own thesis there, because you're saying that you can concentrate on the mantra and the meaning of the mantra.
No, when you start the mantra, or at least at the time that you're starting the mantra, you may have a practice which allows you to focus, whether it's visualization or whether it's words, and the mind is difficult. The sound allows you to shut off other distractions. Mm-hmm. And then the next step in the mantra is, where is that mind going and where are you focusing that mind?
So that the practice? Sound is perceived by the mental consciousness, right?
Yes.
Is understanding.
So it's sequential,
that.
Yes.
But to a certain degree, right now, the example I was giving before, if you look at me, if I look at you, and if you were speaking to me at that time, I can have a partial, my mental consciousness can be paying partial attention to the visual input, partial attention to your, you know, to the sound that's coming, that you're making, the words that you're saying. You seem to be saying that's impossible, that it's sequential, that I must be going full attention to the visual, then full, maybe a moment of full attention to the auditory and back and forth.
Yes, because if you were paying full concentration to if what you were, I'm
yeah,
saying,
yeah, but I'm
yes.
saying not full attention. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
The mental consciousness has the ability to yes. divide its attention slightly, but if it gets spread out too much,
that's true. We
then
don't
you're not
disagree.
Paying attention.
I agree.
Oh, okay.
So the
you
whole
were
purpose,
you were saying that was
I'm just saying
that was a myth that you could
yes.
do two things at one time.
Yes, so that's semantic.
For
it's
instance,
semantic.
We have this expression in English. I'm so bad I can't walk and chew gum at the same time.
Well, we don't like chew that. Gum in
yeah,
Singapore.
Okay, it's a bad example in Singapore. It's against the law, I guess. But say, sorry. You take a step, and you can't. You know, then you. Sure, then you take a step. Sure. But you can do both at the same time, right? You can see someone and be listening to them, and it depends. If what they're saying is something very important or dramatic, or you may be paying more attention to that, and the visual input to your
yes.
eyes will become...
Yes,
of
course.
It's your own experience. But you said before it's impossible.
No, I didn't say
you
it's impossible.
You said that it's a myth that you can do these things, that it has to be sequential.
The language that's used today, multitasking, is giving us the impression that we can actually have fairly good concentration, full
okay,
concentration
now you're
for many
qualifying.
Things.
Okay, yes. I agree with that.
All I'm saying is that when we talk about full concentration, is focus.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Well, this example yes. I gave, say if you're driving the car, you might think that you can multitask, you can be talking to your friend at the same time, maybe chewing gum or, I don't know, taking notes, I don't know. But obviously, in doing so, you are paying less and less attention, even though you might be sequentially putting a little more attention on one than the other, you know, something, you know, the car starts to swerve, so your attention goes here and you're not listening. But you can pay partial attention to some things. And so I don't think, at the end, I think you're kind of agreeing with that.
Yes.
You can pay, okay.
No,
okay.
Yeah,
you said that
most of us have distractions. And so when we start the practice at any point in time, the degree of distraction varies for all of us, depending on our personalities, our practice, etc., etc. But really, it's a question of full attention and distraction, right?
I think you can have partial attention, and that's generally what we have now. You know, it's not a matter of all or nothing. You can have right now. Say, for instance, if you try to concentrate on your mind. And your mental consciousness, part of it will be a little bit distracted. Part of it's paying attention to maybe some ambient pain in the body or some worry. There may be times when you sequentially pay more attention to one or the other, but the mind does have the capacity to pay partial attention to several things, several. One or two things, depends on the capacity of your mind. Okay. Anyone else? Yeah, what?
Yeah, we pursue your classes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the four placements of consciousness, or close placements of consciousness. Of mindfulness. In Tibetan, Dempa Nirshak. Dempa means mindfulness. In Sanskrit, Smirti. In Sanskrit, we talked about, in Pali, we talked about before, this means Sati, right? being is the factor of the mind that is holding something in mind, keeping in mind, kind of like the glue that keeps you on that object. Satipatthana in Pali. So we mentioned the context of this. One of the first of the 37 limbs of enlightenment that the Shravaka, the Pratyeka Buddha, or the Bodhisattva begins to practice, and they really properly begin to practice this on the path of accumulation, the beginning of the path. And the reason for doing so, it says in the text, is at first to familiarize and start to understand better the Four Noble Truths. My mouth is dry. It may have come out the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths. So I remember asking, you know, the very famous, very popular nowadays when people talk about Satipatthana courses, they may think the main thing is watching the breathing, and then in the intermediate, doing walking meditation. You know, have you done? Here or some other place? So, okay. And eating, watching, you know, being conscious, being mindful of everything that you're doing. I asked one of the great Tibetan lamas, Kepchi Song Rinpoche, who is the teacher of many of our present lamas, was one of the, I had the fortune of being present when he gave many teachings. I wouldn't say that I heard them. My mind might have been distracted. But I asked Song Rinpoche once, why that in the Tibetan tradition we don't have this, you know, walking meditation, and not so much, you know, we don't spend weeks doing breathing meditation, mindfulness on the breathing, mindfulness on the walking. And he said something that was very, very interesting, I thought. He said, generally in the Mahayana, the main object of mindfulness is the what we call lojong, the training of the mind. So being mindful of the kindness of sentient beings, being mindful of the defects of the self-cherishing thought, the benefits of cherishing others, being mindful in breathing, being mindful of when you do your breathing, breathing in the suffering of all sentient beings when one is trained. You know, you don't just do that from the beginning. You have to understand the context of that. Imagine taking on every breath, taking on the suffering of sentient beings, sending out all of your good qualities, your merits, with taking on their suffering with compassion, sending out your qualities with love, and developing the thought of this, what was called this, laksam, the special thought or altruistic intention, recognizing that simply wishing them well, taking on their suffering and sending out goodness to them doesn't change them. That you must, in order to enact this goal, you must become a Buddha. So using that to develop bodhicitta. He said that was the main object in the Mahayana. But that doesn't mean that the bodhisattvas don't meditate on these four close placements of mindfulness. They definitely do. And the purpose, one of the purposes at the beginning, is to get familiar with the Four Noble Truths. So how does this work? So in meditating on being mindful of the body, and maybe I can ask some of you who've done some courses with Alan about this, but you know how you integrate it, how you understand the breathing and the walking meditation is related to this, but I'll get to that in a second. Generally, when you meditate, when you close placement of mindfulness on the body is supposed to be at the beginning one of the ways to familiarize yourself with the truth of suffering. So recognizing, contemplating, meditating on the body as having this nature of being a problem. It's impermanent. You know, it's changing. It will, you know, we recognize that, as we talked in one of the other classes, that gross impermanence will eventually have to die, although that may be not something we're paying attention to. But every moment, the body is changing and getting closer to that eventual death, which is a problem, because we're attached to this body. To be mindful of the body as being, the nexus of the various kinds of suffering, what we call the suffering of suffering, is experienced by our body, of course by our mind also, but by our body. Changeable suffering, pleasurable things that will, even as we watch in our body the experience, changeable suffering is something which is, we call happiness, but is actually turns eventually into suffering. And even at the moment that we're experiencing it, is not real happiness. It's just the alternation, reduction of one suffering, replacing it with another. Even when we have neutral feelings, the body is the nexus of what's called pervasive suffering. You know, just having a contaminated body while we have it, in any one moment, the next moment, we can experience suffering of suffering. I remember one of the first meditation courses I attended at Kopan in 1974, or the very first one I attended in 1974. After the course, during the break, so some people were going out for pee-pee break, right? We were in the tent, and Lama Zopa was looking at the clock he's just sitting there waiting for people to come back, and he's looking at his hand, and he said, "Yeah." He's felt some like little, maybe a thorn or something in his finger or something, and he said, "Even this pore of the body, you know, can be the source of suffering, in the sense that as long as we have a contaminated body, that is." Come about because of contaminated karma and delusions. It is the nexus, the womb from which all the different kinds of suffering can come. Even if at one moment something seems, you know, like, oh, how could that ever be suffering? You know, you could be bitten on the ear, or you could feel suffering in some place of the body that you don't. Right now, it feels a neutral feeling. It can change. So the point of being mindful of the body has to do with recognizing, becoming familiar with the truth of suffering and its various aspects. You know, the various aspects of the truth of suffering. You know, the four aspects of the truth of suffering. What are they? You nod, but you don't want to give the answer. Those are the four noble truths, right? What are the four aspects of the first truth? Impermanence, suffering, empty, and selfless, right? So one would sit and be mindful of the body, of its impermanence, taking that to mind, even watching that, the subtle impermanence, watching if you have the ability to observe the subtle impermanence. Now, I'm just curious, people do the breathing meditation, there's a way of integrating breathing and the walking meditation as being related to this first mindfulness of the body. Can you explain? Who is the microphone? Oh, yeah. You have to hold it down for a second till the light goes on. There you go.
You mean when you're breathing at the same time you're doing walking meditation?
No. Well, like, say, for instance, I think in some of the Satipatthana courses, not in Ellen, but, you know, supposedly the breathing, watching the breath in the Satipatthana courses is considered to be under the mindfulness of the body. And the walking meditation and eating mindfulness is said to be mindfulness of the body. So how are they, is that immediately relatable to the recognizing the truth of suffering?
It seems that it's just like being aware of your body as you walk, then every step you are aware of the movement, even raising up your hand, your legs. Every movement, you know, there's a pause and there's a ending and coming and going sensation. And of course, then you will when experience expect, you will actually realize there's impermanence of coming and going. I'm up and down. You're aware of this leg, then you're aware of the other leg. There's every movement is the awareness of impermanence.
Okay. You understand? So that's generally considered, those activities are generally considered to be mindfulness on the close placement of mindfulness on the body. So one of the major things being impermanence, so that recognizing the change, you know, and so forth. But particularly the suffering aspect of that. What happened? Oh, it just sort of stopped suddenly, huh? Oh, it's a new mic. We have to give it a different name. Maybe Philip.
Impermanence.
Mike sounds too. Okay. So the other aspect of all of these close placements of mindfulness is this. You may know that to develop single point of concentration, we have to develop what's called calm abiding, shamatha. Right? What is the basis for shamatha? We talked in some of our... Philip here now. What's the basis for single point of concentration, for calm abiding? It's ethics, morality, the higher training of morality. What's the basis? In what way can we keep ethics, keep our vows? We have to be mindful of ourselves all the time. So mindfulness is one of the factors. If you take vows of a monk or nun or as of a layperson or bodhisattva vows or tantric vows, you have to be mindful all the time. You should be mindful all the time. So, you know, you almost have to multitask. She won't accept. I'm just teasing. Almost you have to multitask because, you know, you're walking and you have to be mindful not to step on insects. You have to be mindful... and not to be breaking your vows and so forth when you plan your meals and so forth. So mindfulness is a base, is first of all an essential element in keeping proper morality, which then is the basis for developing concentration, which also requires mindfulness. So the practice of close placement of mindfulness can be begun even before entering the path of accumulation. It's not
what we practice now before the path of accumulation is not technically fully qualified close placement of mindfulness, but it's still a practice of that. Just as our practice of the bodhisattva perfections, you know, we try to practice the perfection of generosity and ethics and so forth. Right now, as we have not entered into the path, the Mahayana path, we haven't reached the first bhumi. It's not fully qualified perfections. But still, the close placement of mindfulness that we have right now, one of the benefits of it is that keeping something in mind in between the sessions, if in the meditative session you're being mindful of the breathing... Hello? Hello? Did we hear something from another realm? Oh, there's something interesting happening. Yeah. Or maybe that microphone that he took out, he's with someone who was speaking. Oh, that's interesting. Did you catch what they said? Okay. So there are many, many advantages of this. In the meditative session, you'll be mindful of your breathing. And you're honing, sharpening, improving your ability to be mindful of something, keep something in mind without being distracted. So you're trying not to multitask at all. You're trying to keep one thing in mind. And then without giving up that state of awareness, that the honing of the mindfulness in between sessions, when you're walking, wherever you're walking, you're mindful of your walking without letting your mind be distracted to other thoughts. When you're eating and so forth, even I think, do they give a special meditation for going to the toilet? Mindful? No? You can. You can also, you know, everything that you're doing when you're sleeping. So the first of these, the first of the close placement of mindfulness on the body is mainly to familiarize oneself or enter into understanding of the truth of suffering. Why is that? Because as one progresses along the path, the Four Noble Truths are the main objects of concentration of your analysis. Even though we're going to be focusing from the Mahayana point of view on one of the aspects, on the emptiness of all of those things, the emptiness of suffering, the emptiness of the origin of suffering, the emptiness of the cessation of suffering, which is like the emptiness of emptiness, the emptiness of the path that leads to that. Still, the Four Noble Truths, which is common with the Theravada tradition, the Hinayana tradition, the Buddha's first discourse to the five disciples, his five disciples, was on the Four Noble Truths. So this is when, even on the path of seeing, when you're, from a certain point of view, you're said to have a direct perception of emptiness, the object that you're taking the emptiness of are the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. That's the main thing that you're meditating on. Then the close placement, so this is the beginning. Later, as you have mindfulness on the body, there are other meditations to do also. Then the close placement of mindfulness on the feelings. The feelings meaning, again, as we said before, it doesn't mean emotions or I have feelings for you or something. It means the simple cessation or feeling of a pleasure, pain, or indifference. So the close placement of mindfulness on the feelings, if one has given up now, given up mindfulness of the body, and now has begun to focus on the feelings, the sensations within the body, one recognizes them. The purpose of doing this is to introduce yourself to the truth of the origin of suffering. How are feelings related to the origin of suffering? Well, in a couple of ways, in an immediate way and in a long distance way. Whenever we have a pleasant feeling, it's the instigator, it's a condition for our mind to develop attachment or craving for that, craving to have that feeling endure. That's why, you know, after eating one piece of chocolate or durian, whatever you like, you know, you feel some pleasant thing. That's why, you know, because of that pleasant feeling acting as a condition, the seeds within our consciousness of attachment are activated due to the object, this pleasant feeling. And that craving then, that attachment, induces you to take another bite, you know, to have more. When we feel anything that's unpleasant feeling, we also have a craving, or actually probably the more precise word to use, even in this case, is thirst. There's a Pali word, trista. How do they say in Pali? Maybe I'm reciting the Sanskrit. Trista means thirst. In the you know the 12 links, what we call craving, grasping, becoming. Actually, the craving is a translation of the Tibetan word we translate as craving is actually the Sanskrit word trista, which means thirst. Like when you have thirst, thirst is kind of we relate with, it's not just a state, it's of body needing moisture. We refer to it as a mental state, right? Thirsting for something, wanting to have something. So related with the word craving, you can use thirst or craving, thirsting, craving. So when we feel an unpleasant feeling, do we have a thirst for that? We have a craving or thirst to be free of that. So thirst doesn't mean, that's why maybe translating as thirst doesn't resonate with your mind. Maybe craving makes a little more sense in that context. We have a craving to be separated from that. And that rises within our mind, and that gives an impetus to develop anger or some kind of... Generally, when we talk about all of the mental states that derive from the three poisonous minds, you know the three poisonous minds, right? Attachment, anger, or hatred, and ignorance. So all of the minds that arise connected with hatred, including anger, which is not as strong as hatred, you know, they could be called repulsive minds. The states of mind that arise with attachment are states of mind that would like to have something, my terminology, so you'd like to have these things within your ego sphere. Do you catch my play on words here? You know, the modern ecological movement, they call it the ecosphere, right? So I'm saying the ego sphere is that which you associate with your own being. So things that are attractive you'd like to have, you have a certain sense of craving to have them within your ego sphere, you know, to either be experienced immediately or to have them accumulated that you can use later, your stash, your stash of money or, you know, your durian, whatever. Things that are unpleasant you'd like to have outside of your ego sphere. So it generates states of mind. That feeling of unpleasant feeling is a condition to give rise to all of the states of mind that are related with hatred, that are like anger and repulsion. We, you know, speaking out, being irritated, Almost having no control. Neutral feelings give rise to a sense of related with ignorance, a basic state of ignorance that doesn't recognize the nature of the objects, which also perpetuates these things. Say, for instance, in the some of the form and formless realms, the higher realms, the higher form and formless realms, there's not even a feeling of pleasure. There's just a neutral feeling. But even that neutral feeling is experienced with a certain thirst. This is an example that's given sometime, a certain craving, if one was beginning to die from that state, one would be thirsting to keep that, grasping, holding, craving to keep that neutral feeling that one has been accustomed to. It's more subtle. You might think that would be, how could that be better than feeling bliss? The bliss is a little bit like bling, a little bit from the point of view of the higher form realms. A little bit too strong, so just to be in that neutral state. But there's still this thirst or craving for that. So close placement of mindfulness on the feelings is meant to familiarize yourself with the truth of the origin of suffering. Suffering originates immediately, in our ordinary experiences with craving to have this pleasant experience that we're having right now, craving to be free of unpleasant experiences, so anger and repulsion out of your ego sphere, and neutral feelings giving rise to a thirst to keep that neutral feeling, just to be in that state. If you're just sort of in a neutral state, just to be disturbed from that, even not talking about the form realms, there'll be a certain irritation if you're disturbed from that, a craving or thirst to remain in that neutral state. Long term, excuse me, or longer term, at the time of death, the karmic imprints in our mind, there'll be some karma that will be activated that will throw us into the next lifetime, into a continuity of samsaric rebirths. How does that karmic seed, that particular karmic seed, get activated? Is it just random? Whatever's strongest? Sometimes some strongest, yeah. It has something to do with it. The strongest ones are going to be the ones most prevalent, even though you might be able to activate some more subtle ones. What activates the seeds, do you know? Time of death? These two links, craving and grasping, or thirst, and what's Alex used some word in his exodus, and a rat. I think he gives some example. I'm not sure if this is from the scriptures or his own example. A rat who's fallen into the water and is drowning and is grasping out at anything to hold on to, even stronger than the thirst. So there's two links that are a little more intensifying. They are the links. At the time of death, they begin to grasp at keeping a continuity of life. So what one is thirsting for, what one is afraid of at that point, is losing life. So one is grasping at that, and it may activate the strongest of those seeds that have been, during your lifetime, that have been modified, and the ones that are more, they say the oldest ones ripen first, they become more powerful. The ones that have been activated because of your various activities of this lifetime and previous lifetimes, But the craving and the grasping at the time of death, the thirst and the grasping, that, you know, holding on to life, that is what's said to be the origin of, you know, the next instant. What's the third link after that? Craving, grasping, and they call becoming, or how I'll say translate, existing, becoming. Okay. What it mean? What is that? Is that a delusion? Craving is a delusion, right? An affliction. Thirst, trista, it's a form of attachment. Grasping is a stronger form. Now frantic, like the rat grasping to, or you know, the rat. I remember one of the things I remember as a child was we were in Wisconsin in the lake. And my mom and dad were there, and they're talking to my aunt and uncle. They're adults. The water only comes up to their waist. I was a little boy, and I was next to them, and I was sinking in the water. And I'm like that rat, I think, you know, grasping at something, afraid I was, you know, I was going to drown. I think that's why I never learned to swim well. It can be something like that. So craving and grasping are both afflictions, right? You know, of the 12 links. What is becoming? Is that an affliction? Well, someone said, I heard, karma is actually an action. So what does it mean? Is it a separate kind of action? What is it? It's actually the karmic seed having been activated, a karmic seed that was on our consciousness having been activated, so that now it's ready. That's the one that's going to be given rise to. That's what's going to throw us into our next lifetime, into a continuity of samsara. So if you wanted to cut off, like if you understand the 12 links, if you want to cut off the continuity of taking rebirth, you have to cut off that activated seed. You have to prevent that activated seed. How can you do that? You have to prevent grasping, to prevent that, to eliminate the possibility of that. You have to prevent craving or thirst. So that's why in the Theravada tradition, when they talk about what the root of samsara is, they say trista, thirst. In Mahayana, we usually say it's, you know, grasping to the self of persons or the grasping to the self of phenomena, depending on how you look at it. But still talking, it's from the Mahayana point of view, one can understand that as in the same way. But that's what you're talking about. It's a kind of grasping. It's a kind of attachment. So, being familiar with the feelings. Now, the present feeling, seeing how when you feel a pleasant feeling, it can give rise to you know, all of the mental states that are associated with attachment, you know, pleasant feeling, contentment, wanting to have the continuity of this attachment, and so forth. When you have an unpleasant feeling, something disturbs your quiet, can give rise to anger and repulsion. This morning, when I was getting ready, I'd just taken a shower, and someone kept on knocking on my door. Just this morning, I don't know if they're listening upstairs. There's a PC meeting, or what do they call it? SPC meeting. Aren't you in that meeting? Oh, yeah. I had my towel around my waist. I said, "Who's there?" And it was. What's his name? Chun Hao. But I didn't recognize him because I hadn't seen him. We'd FaceTimed or something before, and he said, "Oh, I just want to talk to you right now, and I'm getting ready for class, you know." And so some angry repulsion rises in my mind, you know. So it's like, "Yeah, who are you? I don't know who you are. Why are you here?" And he said, "I'm Chun Hao." And of course, he pronounces it in correct Chinese way. I would pronounce it Chun Hao. I think he was saying Chun Ho or something. I don't know. "Who are you? Do I know you?" He said, "I'm the head of the SBC." "Oh, okay." So then the mind, you know, the mind can relax a little bit. But so many times, if you're mindful of your feelings, something, the unpleasant feeling of being disturbed from the quiet, or you know, you had some methodical, you were doing something, you were getting ready for class, you're just taking your shower, you don't want to be interrupted while you're putting on your clothes, you've just got 20 minutes left. So the nexus of things associated with anger and repulsion rise. And when you're just in a neutral state, which is more, the example that's given often is the neutral state of the, you know, the higher form realms, where the one has eliminated even the subtle kind of bliss in those states. All one is experiencing is neutral feeling. Just to be disturbed from that, also there's a craving to keep that state, to keep that neutral state, not to be disturbed from it, the craving to keep a pleasant state, the craving or thirst to be free of an unpleasant state. So you know, the ordinary reaction is to try to thrust out and do something to prevent that disturbance. So in a sense, that's how the meditation on mindfulness on the feelings is meant to introduce you to the truth of the origin of sufferings. Then the third one was called the close placement of mindfulness on the consciousness. Here, generally, there may be ways of meditating on the eye consciousness, ear consciousness. Usually it's referring to the mental consciousness. So this might be a little more familiar with you, and this is meant to introduce you to what would be the third noble truth. Cessation, right? Cessation. So one way, in fact, we talk about this when we do our meditation at the beginning, our motivation. I'm asking you to look at your mental consciousness, to be mindful of it, and to recognize its spacious quality, right? The fact that the states of mind that arise within it. Certainly the thoughts are transient, but even the states of mind arise because of some conditions, but they're not permanently within the presence of that consciousness in that clear light nature of the mind. Although to really realize that, you have to realize emptiness. So this particular meditation, watching the consciousness, watching its nature of being, of having the capacity to, you know, the delusions themselves will cease over time within that. They're not constantly within that mind. Although the seeds of the delusions are within the mind, the last of the close placements of phenomena is said to be close placements of mindfulness is the close placement of mindfulness on phenomena. So we say the body, the feelings, introduce you successively to the truth of suffering, the truth of origin of suffering, and then to the close placement of mindfulness on the consciousness, the mental consciousness, which introduces you to the truth of cessation, and finally the close placement of mindfulness on phenomena. Mainly what are meant are the various mental factors, and in going through that, if you look very, very closely, the one that's mainly talked about here, not the negative mental factors, but the factor of wisdom, discrimination, recognizing how it is the path that can lead you out of, you know, that can, it's this wisdom, discriminating awareness, that can realize selflessness and emptiness, that can hold it and hone it, And that's what can, that's the path that can lead to cessation. We've only got a hint of cessation by understanding the clear light nature of the mind. But in recognizing the origin of our, you know, the origin of our suffering coming about because of these delusions, and that the delusions, the root of all of the delusions, is a sense of grasping to the self, grasping to a self of persons, grasping to a self of phenomena. Recognizing that if that could be eliminated, that grasping, that could lead to cessation, if that's the root of the delusions. How could that be eliminated? If we can recognize that there is no self, how do we recognize there is no self? Through the mental factor of wisdom, we call prajna or sherab in Tibetan. So in a sense, these, at the very beginning, and there are other practices, as I understand, that one practices the close placements of mindfulness all the way further on, close placement of mindfulness on the body, the feelings, on cessation and on the the mind and on phenomena as one progresses along the path. So this is just a very, very brief introduction to this. As I said at the beginning, great Tsongkhapa Rinpoche said that in the Mahayana, there's not as much emphasis in this, you know, enduring retreats as there is in the Theravada tradition, the Satipatthana retreats, where one sits for many hours watching the breathing, which is mindfulness, being mindful of the body and the impermanence and the suffering nature of that, being mindful as you're doing walking meditation and eating meditation. Generally, even when we eat, we have a Mahayana meditation to be mindful of offering to the Buddha at our heart, or our future resultant Buddha. Or also practice of guru devotion, imagining the guru at the heart, offering our food to them, being mindful of that rather than being mindful as an introduction to the Four Noble Truths on the nature of suffering. So any observations? Those of you who have done some, I know that Jeffrey and I forgot, what's her name? What's your name? Liu Chu. Lien. Lien, okay, that's right. Lien. So you've both done courses with Alan Wallace on the Four Close Minutes. What can you add or correct from my presentation? He needs, okay. Here. Or is that one working now? You have to hold down the button. See, he couldn't multitask. He had to stand still while holding the button. He couldn't walk.
It's not correcting you. Just a comment. Mm-hmm. Is that because actually we started ABC, studying basic programs and all the mind trainings and bodhicittas, all the bhajana and the Mahayana sutras. And I always hear that just what you said about, what you say about emphasizing on mind training rather than the breath and the body on the Theravada tradition. So after doing all these studies, then I find I'm going to practice in the meditation. Then guess what? If you are alone and you are practicing, all your inspirations are bodhicitta and all these things, it does appear to you, but it doesn't last long. Because my experience is that I'm still holding that these grudges, these feelings, these human things, human problems. And it seems bodhicitta, all these are so aspiration. Yes, we see so nice, inspiring, But when you sit alone, it doesn't work. For you, for me, very not work very lasting. Mm-hmm. Then realized that after attending Adam Waller's teaching, of course, he teach about Pali canons on Theravada to the Mahayana. Mm-hmm. Then I seem to explore, let's try a bit to the Theravada tradition, see whether it work. Mm-hmm. Then I realized that it deal the feeling. It really the antidote to the present feelings on the cold, the grudges, the feelings that I have, the imprint of part this not part but this life of all this habitual tendency. And it seems that the Theravada had to me, it seems to have the antidote immediately. You know how to settle down, the breath, anchor to your body, any problems arise, any mental affliction arise, you know how to deal with it. Instead of thinking about bodhicitta and all these things, you know how to settle immediately, then going to this bodhicitta. I'm not saying that bodhicitta, all this doesn't work.
So can I make a response to that?
Yeah.
So I many years in India, I hung out in India a long time. When I was in Delhi, at our Tushita Delhi, I met some professors at the Indian Institute of Technology, IIT. It's a big place. It's a very famous, one of their higher technological institutes. You know, very top scientists and sharp people. And many of them, they had their own group of Goenka students that practiced with Goenkaji, the famous, what was he, Burmese man, layman, who tried to put into practice the teachings that he had been given by, I think it was one of his Mahasi Sayadaw or one of his great Burmese masters before him. Do you know? Any of you know? So anyway, they would do these courses on Shamatha Vipassana, Satipatthana. And I talked to some that had been doing these courses for 10, 15 years. Every year they'd go off to do a long retreat, either with Goenkaji himself or with some of the disciples. And I said, have you found some good development from that? And they said, look around if no one's looking. And they said, mainly what I found was that when I have some problems, if I go back and I meditate, I watch the breathing, I'm contemplating these things are essentially, they fade away. One gets into a state of calm and so forth. But I still get angry just as easily as before in everyday life. And I said, don't you have antidotes to those? Because generally in the Mahayana teachings that come through, mind training teachings that come through Atisha, that as he studied with Sherlingpa, so close to here, Jambi? Where's Jambi? Which island is that? Sumatra, not Java. Yeah, I kept on saying Java. Someone corrected me, Sumatra. Jambi, he studied for 12 years, received all of these teachings on the mind training, how to apply the antidotes also. So generally, when we're watching the mind, as we study the Lan Rim, maybe that's the part that we didn't get a chance to really meditate on the Lan Rim. We've got a chance to meditate on the close placements of mindfulness, but not the Lan Rim. There are antidotes, temporal and ultimate antidotes to the delusions that you want to, in your mind training, to apply. Like one of the verses of the 8 verses of training the mind is, vigilant of my mind stream in all actions, whenever afflictions arise endangering myself and others, I will confront and avert them without delay. So what that means is, confront them means, first of all, to recognize they're there and to feel, let's say, to confront some delusions that are uncomfortable. You may be motivated to apply the antidotes. Some of them may not be. You may not be motivated to apply the antidote because they're related with a pleasant feeling, like attachment. But to recognize them You know, vigilant of my mind stream through all actions. When delusions arise, endangering myself and others. So if even attachment arises, which is, you know, your pleasant feeling, you're getting thirsting for that, or if, you know, you're just taking a shower and Chen Hao knocks on your door and says, oh, come, can I talk to you? You know, if anger and repulsion arises, you have to apply the antidote to that. So to apply the antidote, you have to know the antidotes. Where are the antidotes? If you look at Shantideva's texts, Bodhisattva Charyavatara, or his text, the Siksha Shamachaya Compendium of Trainings, which has a whole chapter on mindfulness, the four close placements of mindfulness. I think Alan translated that chapter, did he? Pardon? What's the word you're saying? Contiminal? Okay, yeah. So, that was quite interesting to me that these professors at the Indian Institute of Technology, like really intelligent people who had tried to cultivate what they might consider their feminine side, you know, by going, studying about meditation and, you know, they had found that over the years, 10, 16 years, that the main benefit they had found from that practice was that it allowed them to ignore, you know, to get back to a calm state, to let go of the delusions, but not necessarily an active antidote within that. Because generally, in my experience, in the, you know, Alan's trained in the whole Mahayana tradition also, so he knows all the antidotes. But in the general Theravada tradition, maybe the most, you know, the most authentic ones you find in Ceylon and Burma, maybe some of the forest monks in Thailand, that meditate on the impermanence, on subtle impermanence. They try to have a direct perception of subtle impermanence. And just as we talked about in our Lodrig class, from certain of the Theravada points of certain of the Hinayana schools, recognize having a direct perception of impermanence, one recognizes indirectly the emptiness of a permanent self. They consider that to be their ultimate realization. But most people, when they do these Satipatthana courses, they're not meditating on that. That takes incredible effort. It takes also the accumulation of merit through keeping very good ethics as the forest monks or the Burmese monks or the Sri Lankan monks would have. But that is from a Mahayana point of view, or even from some of the other Hinayana schools, that particular realization, even having a bare perception of impermanence, does not eliminate, does not pull the delusions out from the root. That's just a temporary, but that's even far beyond what one generally experiences with just this common presentation of Satipatthana. Lynn, do you have some comment?
My last thing was that the ideas I'm trying to say is the observation part. Okay, we can have a lot of studies, and I do a lot of studies, and but we are lacking of being observed. Are you aware of your feeling now? Are you aware of your body now? The sensations and things like that at the present moment, because I'm lacking to be aware of a feeling, especially feeling, because feeling is the one that will make you create karma, you know, create delusions, anger arise, and everything. So that's one that was so amazing, but just one Tharavada monk, a Burmese monk, a Malaysian monk, just attending his retreat, and he just gave me one big instruction. Aware of your own present feelings.
Beware of what?
Your feeling now, the feelings. Mm-hmm. That this is, I have missed this part. It seems like you study a lot about, I study a lot of things, and you are not aware of these present feelings. So that is something that I might experience, is I miss this part to make it more, oh, I forgot this hole. There's a hole inside me that I did not get into touch with it, my feelings. Okay. I can talk about bodhicitta, a lot of that, but you're not talking about your own, I'm not talking about in the past.
And again, feelings, we're talking about pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Right?
Yes, that's my,
which give rise to
quick temper, anger,
or attachment,
things like
that. Or ignorance, So that's generally what's understood to be the function at the beginning, close placement of mindfulness on the feelings as, to pass on to Lien. Oh, he has a question, okay. To familiarize yourself with the origin of suffering, where the suffering comes from the the feelings, are a condition that give rise to thirst, grasping, and becoming, which then throws you into this continuity of suffering, the origin of suffering like that. So, this is good. That's good. So you have a question?
Yes, I have two. One is, how does, can you please elaborate on how neutral feelings gives rise to ignorance? Usually they say neutral feelings somehow gives rise to ignorance. And how do reincarnate lamas who take human rebirth activate their human body, because they are supposed not to have any grasping and craving? So what's the activation factor for their...
So the first one, so when we talk about thirst, so there's three varieties of thirst or craving. So there's the craving to have something pleasant, which we associate with attachment. There's a craving to be free of what's unpleasant. Is that sort of thrusting away. And then there's like the trista, the thirst of the being who is immersed into the neutral feeling, say in the higher form realm. Not to be disturbed from that. It's grasping. It's holding on. Like when we talk about the roots of the root of the three delusions, the three root delusions, the fundamental of all of them is grasping to true existence, right? Or grasping to a truly existent self. So that's kind of like that, and that is said to be the fundamental ignorance. Nagarjuna Chandrakirti said that this is the real ignorance. This is the main ignorance that gives rise to all of the other delusions. So that thirst is no longer grasping for a pleasant feeling. It's grasping to the neutral feeling, as the person might be passing away, or even during the experience, just when one has that experience, there might be constant seed of that thirst, not to lose that neutral feeling. It's not a thirst to be free of an unpleasant feeling. It's not a thirst to have a pleasant feeling. It's a thirst to have a continuity of existence, that neutral feeling. So we can understand that as kind of that's associated in this case with the example that's given is neutral feelings. It's just a craving to continue existence. It's not a craving to have a pleasant feeling, not a craving to be free of an unpleasant feeling, but a craving to have a continuity of existence, like the drowning rat grasping at anything to keep alive, at that point. How the beings take rebirth. Well, let's say, not talking about reincarnated tukus or something like that, just talking about the Hinayana arhats who then enter into the Mahayana path. How did they do that? They've already gotten rid of all all of the delusions, haven't they? Do they have any self-grasping at all? They don't have any. They don't have any attachment. They don't have any anger, and they don't even have the root of them any longer, the grasping to true existence. So how do they take rebirth? How do they enter back? You know what I'm talking about? The Hinayana arhats eventually are awakened by the Buddhas, and they are encouraged to take rebirth in cyclic existence again, to develop bodhicitta, because they have not finished their own aim or the aim of others. So they use their power of prayer. You know, in the bodhisattva path, we talk about after the sixth bhumi, we talk about four more bhumis when they develop other of the paramitas, one of which is the perfection of prayer. Prayer could also, you can understand what prayer is. Mun lam, it's the path of aspiration. So they aspire to take rebirth. And that can help to ripen, because it's still in their mind stream. There's certain karmic seeds in their mind stream that are still there to take rebirth in cyclic existence, which will not be activated by ordinary grasping, like at the time of death, the trista, the craving, the grasping, and the becoming, you know, the ripening of those seeds. But they can ripen those seeds with their own volition by making very strong prayers, very strong aspiration. It's not like praying to someone else, like, oh, what is it? I remember when I was in Laodo when doing retreat one time, in the afternoons I'd go up on the hill. I had a little AM/FM radio. I'd listen to BBC, and there one time there was this compendium of a cappella music. You know what a cappella is? Yeah. And there was Janis Joplin. Anyone remember? Anyone old enough to remember? You remember Janis Joplin? Oh yeah. No one else? Okay. Anyway, she was. You remember Janis Joplin? No. Yeah. She was singing, "Oh Lord, won't you give me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all have Porsches. I must make amends." There's some long song like this. Maybe you've heard that. Some song she was singing a cappella without any accompaniment and something. So that's often what we think of as prayer, like, "Oh God, please let me pass this exam. I'll be so good." Or you know, "Buddha, Tara, you know, I will offer it." You know, promising something, like praying to someone else to give you something. That's not the meaning of prayer and the perfection of prayer. Prayer might be the perfection of this path of aspiration. So the ability, by your aspiring for something, to ripen the karma to bring that about. You know, like you might pray for wealth. So what the bodhisattvas do is, if they have that, if they are practicing that perfection of what do you call it, prayer or the path of aspiration, they aspire for that virtuous reason, to be able to have resources to maybe build a temple or to help sentient beings. Something is needed, some resources. And that can help to ripen the seeds on your consciousness that will, you know, then that you will find very easily that when the conditions arise, you will have a connection with that, you will have the wealth this lifetime. So the excuse me, Hinayana arhats who are entering the Mahayana path aspire to take rebirth, ripening some of the seeds. So they take rebirth volitionally, with their own volition, with their own desire. Also the tukus, that's generally how also, you know, very strong desire, even if they have not eliminated the delusions completely. So at the time of death, there'll be some craving and grasping, but their power of prayer or aspiration may be stronger. So, you know, most of us are, you know, even we might aspire to be born as a human next lifetime, or, you know, a rich person, or better situation that we have now. Just our aspiration is not going to overpower our craving and grasping at the time of death. But higher beings who've realized emptiness and their own afflictions are very much reduced, even if they haven't realized it directly, if they're on the path of preparation or even the path of the accumulation or in the tantric realm of things, by various meditations, the afflictions are very much reduced. Their aspiration can help to ripen the seeds that are on their consciousness and give their next rebirth. That's my understanding. So the end has a question. Or more than one. Or comment. No, here, this way. Where are you going? No, you had some. You said, no? Oh, you didn't? Oh, okay. You don't know. Okay. Anyone else have a question? Or comment? Okay. So this was just like two classes we've had only, just like very short time. So I encourage you to, you know, to investigate this subject as there may be opportunities. I think Alan Wallace is, either he's in Singapore right now or he's coming in a couple of days. I don't think he's giving any courses now, but if you have a chance to, in the future, to do one of his courses, that might be very useful, because he can give, as Jeffrey and Leanne have taken these courses, maybe some of you, anyone else have taken some of these courses? Yeah. So give a good perspective from the Theravada, the Mahayana, even the Dzogchen Tantra point of view on these four close placements of mindfulness. Yeah. Yes.
In relation to Mahayana tradition,
yeah,
would you have any recommendations on the books to read on the four close placement of mindfulness? Because I know there are a lot in Theravada tradition. Yeah, thank you.
That's what, as I said, in the Tibetan tradition, in our, let's say, even in the Tibetan tradition, in our Gelugpa tradition, I don't know about the Sakya Nyingma and Kargyu so much, but in the Gelugpa tradition, it is mentioned in some of the commentaries. Usually it comes up in the subject of Prajnaparamita, where the monks and nuns study. And it comes in mentioning how the 37 limbs of enlightenment, or wings of enlightenment, are practiced successively by the Bodhisattvas, if you talk about from the Mahayana point of view. So those texts, there hasn't been, I don't know of any text that's published in English. Do you know? What is that?
There's one translated by Dr. Alan Wallace on the Santideva text.
By Alan?
Alan, yes.
Oh, yeah, but that chapter, right?
Chapter 13.
That's what I was saying before.
Chapter 13.
Alan has, the other people have translated also. In Shantideva's text called Siksha Samuchaya. Have you heard of that? What's the famous text that we usually think of Shantideva having written? Bodhisattva Charyavatara, right? Yeah. So he wrote another text, so the Siksha Samuchaya. Samuchaya means compendium. You know, there's also Nargarjuna and some other people wrote texts called Sutra Samuchaya, which was like, and Nargarjuna wrote a compendium of sources from the sutras that presented the Mahayana point of view and, you know, about difficult subjects. Siksha Samuchaya is a compendium of trainings. And that has been translated. It was translated in the 1890s, I think. You can still find that translation, sort of old English, not really understanding the Mahayana path, so that may not be so reliable. Someone more recently translated the entire text. If you look on, and I can't remember the person's name off the top of my head, translated that entire text. So that chapter within Shantideva's text is on the four close placements of mindfulness. What did you say? It had a particular title? 13. 13, very auspicious number. So Alan Wallace, I don't know if he's translated the whole text, but he's translated that chapter, and I believe that's available without charge on the internet. So if you search for Alan Wallace, Alan with one L, right? One L. Alan Wallace. And if you put .pdf, dot, you know, and then put close placements of mindfulness, or Shanti Devas, you'll find, you'll eventually find that. But there aren't, the other texts may be translated in English, but are not totally available, like the ones from the Kalupa textbooks. One of the texts that I studied was the a commentary on the Abhisamaya Alamkara. So what we had was the Prajnaparamita texts, which explained the perfection of wisdom. Then there were the Prajnaparamita, the three main ones, we say 100,000 verse, 25,000 verse, 8,000 verse. Not very easy to understand. It's like what is the Buddha talking about? He's just going from this subject to this subject. So Maitreya Buddha wrote a commentary, or he gave a commentary to that, to a Sangha in Tushita Heaven. And that text a Sangha brought back to earth was called Abhisamaya Alamkara. So in that text, Maitreya explained what the point of the Prajnaparamita was, that the Buddha was mentioning the path structure. Explicitly, he was talking about emptiness of this, the emptiness of this, but the things he was taking as the subjects, the emptiness of this path, the emptiness of feelings, the emptiness of the four close placements of mindfulness, all of these things were indicating the path structure, how the bodhisattva progresses along the path, which was implicit and slightly hidden. It was there. He was talking about it. He was mentioning all these things, but it wasn't clear. So that text, Abhisamaya Alamkara, is the main text that's used when the students study the perfection of wisdom, when they begin to study in the monastic system. Later they study the text that is simply talking about emptiness, the Majjhimaka. When they're studying that, there's even commentaries to that, to Abhisamaya Alamkara, to explain what it means, because it's very, very succinct. And one of the Lama Tsongkhapa's disciples, main two disciples, wrote a commentary to that. And in there, he gave some explication of that. I'll see if I can find any translation of that and see, provide for you. So let's end. It's just 12 o'clock, 12:05, 4. Let's dedicate the energy that we've created this morning recognizing that we've created virtuous karma, hopefully, unless you're in an angry state right now. We've created virtuous karma, listening patiently, adding our comments, thinking about the teachings, and recognize that this karma will definitely ripen within cyclic existence unless it's destroyed, or unless we achieve liberation before it ripens. So to, like the reins of a horse, to try to aspire, to dedicate this. So dedication is a kind of prayer, a path of aspiration, but here it's not just aspiring for something to happen in the future, for some karma that's already on our mind stream to ripen, but the very karma that we're creating, that we've just created right now, aspiring that it ripen in a particular way in the future. So already putting it into a certain direction. Whatever way this these virtues ripen. May they become the cause of my continued spiritual development. Up to and including enlightenment. In whatever way they ripen, may they not simply be the cause of giving rise to attachment, if it's something pleasurable, or pride, or jealousy, but may they become the cause of my cause and conditions of my continued spiritual practice, up into including enlightenment for the welfare of all sentient beings. Thanks for your patience and your good comments, your intelligence. Tomorrow they'll be finishing up. We'll be talking about the Mahayana paths and grounds some more. And this coming week, Tuesday, Thursday, a beginning set of four lectures for Tuesday, Thursday on the mind and mental factors. I think it's called If the Mind is King. What is it called? If the mind is principle, If the mind is main, if the mind is chief, who are its accomplices or something like that? So you're welcome to come. So see you soon. Take care. Yes. Oh, I thought it was the Mahayana passage. Oh, okay. Thanks for telling me. I'll have to prepare for that. Thank you very much.